Hey, Tenderfoot listeners. I'm Liam Luxon, host of Status Untraced, a new podcast brought to you from the team behind Up and Vanished. It follows my investigation into the disappearance of Justin Alexander, a survivalist and world traveler whose life seemed like it was torn from the pages of an adventure novel. While some of Justin's friends and family believe he may have been murdered, it's not clear what actually happened. And a message he left behind just days before he vanished makes everything about his disappearance just strange. Check out this clip featuring one of Justin's friends and their recollection of their final conversation with him.
It was one thing that kind of made me feel weird about whenever he'd talk about his plans for India. And the more I've thought about it, especially over the years, it almost seemed like he was preparing for something because he wanted to be famous. He made that openly clear, like that was his end goal.
When you hear the message Justin left behind, when you hear about the remote and dangerous area where he went missing, when you learn about how the suspects and the police's efforts in this case all quietly started to fade away, you won't be able to stop wondering what happened. From Tenderfoot TV, Status Untraced is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts or subscribe to Tenderfoot Plus to binge the entire season ad-free. Learn more at tenderfootplus.com.
Hey guys, it's Rob here. Unfortunately, pain is a little under the weather, so I'll be hosting today's episode. Today we're going to discuss all of the latest developments in reference to the gag order in Tara Grinstead's case. If you recall, a few weeks ago, the judge issued a gag order, preventing any friends, family, law enforcement, or any potential experts or witnesses from speaking about this case. Since the judge's ruling, several prominent media outlets joined forces and filed a motion opposing this gag order. Last Thursday, March 16th, Judge Melanie Cross held a hearing at the courthouse in Ocilla to address the motions that were filed to lift the gag order. Today we'll be hearing the audio from the courtroom as both sides plead their cases to the judge in favor of and against the gag order. This is Case Evidence. The first thing we'll do today is listen to the courtroom audio from last Thursday, March 16th. Just a fair warning, it's pretty long. We've trimmed out as much of the dead time as possible, but it's otherwise completely unaltered. If you want to jump straight to Philip Holloway's discussion, you can forward to around the 51-minute mark. After listening to the courtroom audio, Philip will be discussing his thoughts on the outcome of this proceeding.
Court, come to us.
Afternoon, everybody. Please have a seat. Let's go ahead and get started. I believe everybody knows why we're here this afternoon, but you need to make sure. I know Mr. Hudson was going to be participating by phone. Is that correct? All right. Does somebody have him online? Okay. You can hear me, Mr. Hudson? No, I think he's more worried about hearing what you have to say rather than what I have to say. All right, and for the record, let's, and for me, of course, I know everybody over here at this table, but over here at this table, if you would introduce yourselves.
Leslie Gaker, Your Honor, for the Journal Constitution, the Associated Press, and WSBT.
All right.
Your Honor, Derek Bauer for WNACT and WXIAT.
Okay.
And Your Honor, Ian Burnside, also here for WXIAT and WNACT.
All right, very good. Mr. Mobley, first question for you this afternoon is, I know your client is not present.
Yes, he is not. I've consulted with him and I waive his presence.
Okay. All right, very well, Mr. Bowden. Here, with regard to the motions to intervene and the motions to lift or to modify the gag order that the court has placed in this particular case, what I would like to do is, of course, have the attorneys who have filed the motions present their arguments. And then Mr. Mobley, Mr. Bowden, if you have anything in response, be happy to hear from y'all as well. So I don't know if y'all have drawn straws to see who goes first or what.
WSB filed a motion first, Your Honor.
Okay.
We'll go
second. All right, Ms. Gaither, you may begin then.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll bring Mr. Hudson.
Okay.
We appreciate the court's time and consideration this afternoon. I will admit at the outset, it's procedurally a little bit odd because of the gag order. I have not seen the motion upon which the order was granted, so I may say things that are incorrect. I apologize to the court, but we're working with what we've got here.
That's perfectly okay.
This case involves defendant Ryan Duke, arrested on February 24th and charged in connection with the death of Karen Winstead, who disappeared in October of 05. On February 28th, the court, on defendant's motion, entered a gag order basically covering prosecution, law enforcement, the defendant, the counsel for defendant, unidentified potential witnesses, unidentified expert and other court personnel, and family members of the victim and the defendant. The order related to all matters relating to the case. This has been read not only as a gag order, but also effectively as a sealing order under Superior Court Rule 21, because the clerk's office is, because they are subject to the gag order, they have taken the position that they cannot release records or docket information in this case. We are here today because we would ask the court to reconsider the gag order on two bases. One, there is no evidentiary record or finding of prejudice which could support the order, and two, because it is overbroad on its face. It has been long recognized by the Supreme Court of the United States and of Georgia that public access to the judicial system is an indispensable attribute of our judicial system. This is also true with respect to speech about the judicial system and the court system. And it is with this backdrop that gag orders are evaluated. As we set forth fully in our brief, in Nebraska Press Association v. Stewart, the United States Supreme Court effectively held that an order that restrains the news media directly, which is not exactly what we have here, is a form of prior restraint which carries a heavy presumption against constitutional validity. Even when an order does not directly restrain the press, however, but only restrains trial participants, it nonetheless faces substantial constitutional barriers. In this state, the leading gag order case in this state is Atlanta Journal Constitution versus State, a 2004 Court of Appeals case, where the court reversed a gag order in a very high-profile case in which the pastor at the House of Prayer Church was charged with molestation and various acts related to members of the church. And in that court, the court said, a conclusory representation that publicity might hamper a defendant's right to a fair trial is insufficient to overcome the protections of the First Amendment. Accordingly, the court held, in order to have a gag order on trial participants, there must be a finding that extrajudicial statements will have a substantial likelihood that materially prejudices the trial, and there would need to be one specific findings of fact based on evidence of the record regarding the impact of the statements. The order would have to permit the type of non-presidential statements of the type that are allowed in the Georgia Rules of Professional Conduct, specifically Rules 3.6 and 3.8, and any restrictions on non-lawyers should be entered with particular care because there is a significant risk that in those instances such an order would be overbroad. This requires a finding not of volume of publicity, but of actual prejudice, and also a finding that there are no alternatives other than the gag order. Shepard versus Maxwell, the United States Supreme Court case, which is cited in the court's order, is a bit instructive as you know what may or may not be enough. In Shepard, where they did actually have a gag order, the court found, among other extraordinary facts, the media was permitted to sit above the bar during trial. They were permitted to publish the names and addresses of potential jurors prior to voir dire. They were allowed to touch evidence, and they were stationed next to the jury room. Even then, the court refused to find that pretrial publicity alone was sufficiently enough for reversal, relying heavily on the fact that the trial judge had refused to change a venue motion, had refused a request for jury sequestration, and that other alternate requests to closure were denied. As I said, we contend that the court's order here does not comply with the law and should be vacated for two reasons. One, there is no evidentiary record or finding of prejudice. AJC versus State is clear. There must be specific findings of fact based on evidence of record regarding the possible impact of extrajudicial statements. And as I said, that is a finding of prejudice, not just volume. The order contains no factual findings. There is no basis to believe that evidence was provided to the court when the order was sought. Georgia law is clear again and again, even in cases of widespread pretrial publicity, this is Miller versus State, situations where such publicity has rendered a trial setting inherently prejudicial are extremely rare. Rockdale Citizen versus State, pretrial publicity, even pervasive adverse publicity, does not inevitably lead to a fair trial. There must be something more. Otherwise, you can see where a gag order could be requested in every case. And for the second reason we contend the order should be vacated is it is overly broad and subject to misinterpretation. Because of the implications on First Amendment rights, these orders must be narrowly tailored. They must be no greater than necessary. And courts have repeatedly struck down overbroad orders, including some we've provided to the court in the Ross Harris case, in a Victor Hill case in Clayton County, in the House of Prayer case in Agency versus State. And here, the order cannot be any broader. And I don't know that, since there was no evidentiary record upon which the order was based, I don't even know where you would begin to narrowly tailor the order because there's no record to do it with. Indeed, at one point, it covers others. It relates to all matters. It has no real expiration date until it does not even expire at voir dire when the jury is impaneled. It does not expire until at least the end of sentencing. And it is arguably in violation of Superior Court Rule 21, which, as we set forth fully in our brief, sets forth very specific procedures that have to be followed before court file can be sealed, and because it is being read as sealing the court file, we would contend that it's in violation of Rule 21. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to reconsider the order.
Thank you, Ms. Gaten. Ms. Bauer?
Thank you, Your Honor. Next, a couple of questions.
Sure.
On behalf of WXIA, which is Channel 1111 in Atlanta, Georgia, and WMAZ, which is Channel 13 in Macon, we are honored to be here arguing for Your Honor, and thank you for giving us the time. We know you've got a very busy schedule. My clients agree with everything that Ms. Gaither just argued. I think she correctly identified the legal problems with the order that the court entered a couple of weeks ago. But let me just start out by saying that our media clients recognize that you have a duty to protect the defendant's rights to a fair trial. Even in civil cases, you've got to protect the party's rights to fair justice in your courtroom. That is a competing duty with the First Amendment rights that are implicated in a gag order. But gag orders restricting speech of trial participants, or as your order does in this case, those who aren't even trial participants, even the most narrowly tailored gag orders are judicial remedies of last resort. They can only pass constitutional muster the rarest and most extreme circumstances, and only where there is no other alternative mechanism that the court can employ to mitigate against truly prejudicial pretrial publicity. We certainly recognize that this case is being brought in a small community. The jury pool is by definition smaller and more limited than in larger communities. But the existence of publicity alone, even as Ms. Gaither pointed out, pervasive publicity, that's not enough to justify an order from a court restricting speech under settled constitutional and Georgia law. And just because there's publicity, and just because the community in which the publicity is relevant is small, those are not constitutionally permissible grounds to enter a gag order of any scope. I think it's important in this case to point out that, just as a matter of fact, not all publicity is bad publicity. In the media, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly, gets a bad rap, I think. But not all pretrial publicity, even in high-profile cases like this one, is bad. And I think this case is a very good example of that notion, Your Honor. This was a cold case. This was a frozen case. It had exhausted law enforcement resources for a decade. If it were not for
media interest and continuing investigation into this case, it's likely there would not have been, and almost certainly would not have been, the important breaks in this case that now have this case pending in this court. So if anything, I think the record before the court shows that this particular case is built on a record that emphasizes the important and valuable role that news media can play in the administration of justice. It's not all bad just because it exists. Doesn't mean there's prejudice, doesn't mean there's injury. This case shows the exact opposite, at least on the record currently before the court. So there's not only been no evidence of record that the press coverage has posed a risk, much less the substantial and certain risk that the law requires, that risk, of course, being to the administration of justice, that the law requires before any kind of restricted gag order can be entered. The record here, I think, demonstrates quite the opposite. But even if that were not the case, Your Honor, none of the pretrial publicity in this case can fairly be said to have risen to a level of irresponsibility or danger to warrant an order restricting speech. And as a point of reference, Ms. Gaither talked about the Justin Ross Harris case. We all know this case. This is the hot car death case from Cobb County from last year. This case has not generated, and I don't think anyone can fairly say it's likely to generate, anything close to the level of statewide and national scrutiny that that case posed and brought. And in that case, although it was requested, Judge Staley rejected a gag order. In that case, although it was requested by the parties, no closure of any court proceedings was granted. And that was notwithstanding serious and pervasive dissections of challenged and disputed evidence in the media, national and local, on an almost daily basis. And that is not the record here, and it can't be, because it just hasn't happened here. Judge Staley had, in that case, the very same duty that you have, Your Honor, to protect the integrity of the judicial process in your courtroom for the litigants that come before you. And when and only when Judge Staley was confronted in that case with actual record evidence of potential prejudice did she consider employing judicial remedies and what they were. And that's how the law is supposed to work. Only when something is presented to you on an evidentiary basis, it rises to a level of almost certainty, substantial risk of prejudice to a party, should the court look at any type of judicial remedy that might close either proceedings, access, or speech to the public. And as you likely know, the remedy that Judge Staley selected in that case was to move the case when it turned out during jury selection that voir dire, searching voir dire and strong instructions to the jury were not going to be sufficient in the judge's discretion to ensure an impartial jury, she moved it. She changed the venue, the trial got moved to South Georgia, and a conviction was had. What Judge Staley did in that Justin Ross Harris case is a textbook case of how the courts are supposed to balance the competing First Amendment and Sixth Amendment rights that are implicated in criminal trials like this. Trials that are of substantial public interest, not just to the community, the immediate community, but beyond. The process should be no different in your courtroom, Your Honor. The court should not consider any restrictions on speech of non-lawyers until a reason to do so is manifest in the evidence. And candidly, Your Honor, we are just not there yet in this case. And frankly, we have no legitimate basis at this point to believe that threshold will ever be met in this case. So for those reasons, on behalf of Channel 11, Channel 13, and Megan, we do not believe that the order that was entered by the court is valid and sustainable. We would ask the court that it be vacated. Ms. Gaither referenced an ancillary issue that I would like to raise as well, and that is that we understand that although there has not been an order sealing court records in this case, which of course, as the court knows, are presumptively open to the public, nevertheless, the clerk appears to be denying access based on a gag order that was in it. Although the standards and process that would apply to reviewing a gag order and access or a closure order when it comes to records access or courtroom access are not identical, as Ms. Gaither pointed out, Rule 21 would apply to sealing of court records. It requires a hearing, it requires evidence, requires the ability of the public to be heard before a closure order can be entered. We would ask the court to clarify with the clerk that until such time as such an order has been entered, presumptive public access to the court's records in this case remains. Your Honor, I would like to save a little bit of time to respond to the district attorney and public defender if a rebuttal is warranted and if it pleases the court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bob. Burnside, are you going to add anything today?
No, I'm going to stick with what Mr. Bauer said.
All right. And Mr. Hudson, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Okay, sir. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you shooting the question yesterday by telephone. I'm David Hudson, and I appeal for children to play for Baker. And as I'm up to date here, the gift of your said, Altria Observer, and the Herald Leader. I agree also with the remarks and the argument made by the Council of the LDLP laws, and I will just stress briefly that this matter of pretrial publicity is a tale of fighting the law. It's overstated. And really, there is no basis for concern about pretrial publicity in the court. We have every confidence in the court. We are all too instigating. And the law is corrupted and stained and it doesn't fit into there's no reason to begin when it arises out of concern for publicity. But in the outline I provided to the court and to the other counsel, the Supreme Court of the United States has made clear that you're not entitled, if you're a defendant, to a jury to settle their anything. You're not entitled to a jury that has a lot of engineers, as the U.S. Supreme Court said in Skiller. It's U.S. Supreme Court case Harvard versus Dodd. The Supreme Court said if you have a standard that you have to have your law, no preconceived notions about the case. An impossible standard. You couldn't beat it. So I will say that U.S. Family Courts recognize that it's okay to have jurors who are about the case, who are about the facts of the case, to be that they expose what the Georgia Supreme Court said in Martell. It's probation and adverse publicity. Now that's not enough to deprive the defendant of his fraudulent grand trial. And it's common sense. If you have a rule that's different than that, you can never try over city bylaws, you couldn't try also mayor model bylaws, you couldn't try in line of defendants, you couldn't try the murder of the Indian battle child murder cases. And there always will be natural file cases, and the courts have mechanisms to deal with it without putting in a gag order. The second point I'm going to make, and it's allowed that, is cases where there have been reversals. There's always some major lapse by the trial judge or serious misconduct by the lawyers in the case. And in the final analysis, the change of venue can cure even those kind of mistakes. On the first page, you have that on the item 2, there are 410 against Supreme Court cases that are usually cited by people who want to shut down communication about a criminal case. And as the Supreme Court suggests, summarize the skill. The most of all cases with the trial atmosphere was totally corrupted by the press coverage. In one case, it was described as a service-like atmosphere. I can't imagine any court in Georgia that would now allow something like that to happen. But Your Honor would allow the media to be walking around the courtroom, handling documents, and interfering with the jury or testimony and so forth. Now, going to the second case, the Irvin case went to the U.S. Supreme Court that involved a domestic violence homicide in a small rural community. And some might argue that, well, Irvin County is a small community and everybody knows something about this case. But the flaw in the Irvin decision is underlined for it that 90% of the jurors who were in town had admitted as guilty innocents. And eight of the 12 have already made up their mind. And that's the kind of thing that can be avoided, is probably avoided by Schwab, that this case goes to trial by appropriate board hour. And if some reason board hour didn't work, there's always a remedy of a change of venue. And that doesn't mean you have to try it in the county other than Irving. The county code section in Georgia now is allowing you to go to a solo side of the county some distance away and select jurors there. Right, because it also up on the trial if that's necessary. Also, page 2, a lot of times the defense lawyers or defendants will say, well, it's Coleman versus Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson. All right, Mr. Mobley, response?
I would agree with Mr. Bauer that the court certainly has a duty to protect the right to a fair trial. That is certainly one of the more basic fundamental rights that we have in this country. And basically, the courts have said that if the court does not protect a prejudicial, protect a defendant from prejudicial pretrial publicity, that right is harmed. And under Georgia law, gag orders are justified if there is a substantial likelihood that extrajudicial statements by trial participants will prejudice a fair trial, and that's from the AJC versus State case that was cited earlier by Ms. Gaither. These standards have also been adopted in the Georgia bar rules, and if the gag order is not directed in this case. I feel like Mr. Duke's right to the trial will certainly be harmed. And I want to remind the court that this is not a gag order that's against all members of the media. So it's not subject to the heavy presumption against constitutionality. And this is a much less stringent standard. In addressing some of the concerns that was raised by Ms. Gaither, I first want to say that I have submitted a proposal to Your Honor and provided a copy to the opposing counsel. In this proposed order that it would amend the original order, I have included that the gag order would include the parties of the defense and prosecution, Mr. Bo Dukes, as well as all current and past members of law enforcement who have been involved in the investigation of this case. So I think that certainly addresses any argument that in order this order would be overbroad. Also, Judge, the main argument that she also made was to the issue of prejudice. And I certainly agree that we would have to show that we were prejudiced by any extrajudicial statements made by any of the trial participants. And to that end, I have submitted to the court and also provided a copy to the opposing counsel, Exhibits 1 through 79. This is just an example of the media coverage that we've been able to locate over just the past 21 days. It is not in coverage going back the past 11 and a half years. It includes various newspaper articles, internet articles, and I would ask the court, before you make a decision and rule on whether prejudice exists, that you would also review these. There are also links to quite a number of web pages. There have been podcasts. There have been international, national, local coverage. And all of this, some of this should be included in the materials that I provide to the court. Also, I provide a copy to everyone of the press conference that was held by the DBI on February the 23rd. This is, as the court knows, one of the biggest cases in South Georgia, certainly the biggest case in Urban County. The media coverage has been constant, it's been pervasive, and while that is not standard for a gag order, that is certainly a good place to start. There's been helicopters, drones, websites dedicated to this, discussion boards, there's photographs, you name it, it's almost daily. Judge, Irwin County has a little over 9,000 people, and I'm afraid that the horse is probably already out of the barn as it relates to a trial here in Irwin County, or even one in the county near you. I would just ask again, as you review these, to see that there's certainly harm, there's some prejudice, especially as it relates to law enforcement statements that they've made thus far. They've discussed the guilt of my client, specifics as it relates to the evidence, as to the experts the states have employed, prior criminal histories of both Mr. Duke and Mr. Dukes. And that's just to name a few. I certainly feel like that any gag order to be effective and useful in this environment has to include law enforcement. Of course, the parties, defense and prosecution, are already bound by the bar rules, so there's things we can and cannot say. In the order that I presented to the court, that my proposed order, it certainly limits what all the parties can and cannot say as related to the rules set out by the bar. But also modeled on the AJC case that was referenced earlier. I've also tried to use an example of an order that's previously been used that was submitted, I believe, by counsel for the AJC and the AP. So I would ask certainly that you consider the order that I have submitted. And we would ask that you certainly assign that order and include all the parties.
Mr. Bowden, is there anything that you'd like to include?
Yes, ma'am. Very briefly, first of all, with respect to the case, the AJC versus the state, that case doesn't stand for the proposition that you cannot issue an ad gag order. You just have to follow the standard, the standard of doing that. If you listen simply to the attorneys arguing on behalf of the various media outlets represented here today, you would believe there'd be no way in the world to ever issue a gag order. That's simply not the case. And we know, while this is not my motion, it was Mr. motion, the state did not object to it. And we feel that certainly the state has a compelling interest that the defendant also receive a fair trial. And that he received a fair sentence. And that's our interest in. In that regard, I do have some information. I will state my place. I relayed this to counsel last night on a conference call. But I have spoken to Mr. John Fox yesterday and the day before yesterday regarding when he represents, he's an attorney at Lack and Macon, and he represents Bo Dukes. I spoke to him twice about this proceeding today. And he has authorized me to state to the court that he would agree for the gag order to be entered. He has no objection to that and has no objection for the inclusion of his client, Mr. Dukes, in that gathering. Yesterday afternoon, he called me. He had received a copy of a proposed order that had been forwarded to him by Mr. Bennett. Mr. Bennett represents Ms. Gaddis, and he had called me about that, talked about that order, and he was concerned that the version of the order sent to him by Mr. Bennett did not include Bo Dukes, and he was questioning me about that. And so he again reiterated that he did not oppose the gag order, did not oppose including his client in the gag order. In fact, said he was opposed to the court in Bendel County would also be like other than that, I think I would allow for Mr. Robinson.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bowden. Mr. Bauer, Ms. Gaither, any response?
Briefly, Your Honor. This first the exhibits that Mr. Bowden is submitting just now, I think they highlight the fact that the order that was entered by the court 3 weeks ago lacked an evidentiary basis with respect to press coverage. And effectively, you're being handed now a volume of press coverage and being told this is the evidentiary basis that would support an order. But it clearly demonstrates that there wasn't one, as the law requires, time the order was entered a couple of weeks ago. But more importantly, Ms. Gaither properly represented the law. Volume of publicity does not equal credits. But even if it did, the law requires that the party seeking a restricted speech order must show why alternatives to a gag order would not cure the credits. We have nothing to suggest that the stack of press covers that was handed to you presents a clear present danger of prejudice to the defendant. All we know is there has been press coverage, and as we know, that's not enough to cross the threshold to justify a prior restraint order from a court in the United States. Again, even if it did, before you even consider curing that prejudice by silencing speech, the court's obligated to consider every other alternative. Order restricting speech is an order of last resort, and we haven't explored any other resorts.
Let me ask you one question. You said an order prior restraint.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, but this order is not directed to the media, so it would not be considered an order of prior restraint, correct?
It is not a prior restraint on the media, but it is a prior restraint on other individuals, many of whom are unknown and unknowable to themselves and to the media. And there is a body of law in the United States that we've cited in our briefs to you, in which the courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, the Brandenburg case, have said that the media has a First Amendment right to gather the news, and even a gag order that silences the speech of witnesses or other individuals with information is a prior restraint on the media's ability to gather the news, which is obviously an essential component of the media's ability to report the news. So it's not quite as clean as suggesting that just because the media is not a line item subject of a gag order, that there's no prior restraint. There's still a prior restraint of other individuals, and there's still a constitutional infirmity on the news media's protected rights under the First Amendment to gather news, which they also enjoy constitutional protections.
Do you agree with his statement that because it's not directed at the media, that there's a less strict or less stringent standard?
I think that's unsettled in our constitutional jurisprudence. But I would say it makes no difference under the Georgia law that's applicable to the entry of restricted speech orders in cases like that. That's what the AJC versus State case says. Now, the DA is absolutely right. That case doesn't say you can't ever have a gag order, and no court would ever say that. But what it says is the bar is very high. And it doesn't matter whether the gag order is limited to trial participants, witnesses, family members, and excludes the media, you still have to meet the same constitutional restrictions in order to be able to enter. That means there has to be actual, substantial likelihood that prejudice exists, not a probability or a concern, or in the words of the public defender, I feel like there is prejudice. The court actually has to have tangible proof of a substantial likelihood that there will, in fact, be prejudice to a right of fair trial. And even if that exists, and I don't think anybody can fairly say that exists on the record in this case at this point, but even if it did, the court needs to tick off all of those other remedies that Mr. Hudson so beautifully articulated in his presentation. You have to consider whether voir dire will cure the problem. If voir dire doesn't cure the problem, perhaps strict, clear instructions to the jury can cure the problem. If that can't cure the problem, then we have to have reasons and evidence reasons why those things would not cure these problems. Then we can move to trial. We can go get a jury pool from another jurisdiction and bring them over here. But all of those things have to be done, analyzed, vetted, and evidence on why they would or would not be effective before the court can go the next step and say, okay, I'm restricting somebody's speech. And that's what the AJC versus State said. That's consistent with the constitutional principles enunciated by the U.S. Supreme Court over and over again. And those cases, I think, were cited in all of the interviewers' papers at the moment. So the only other comment I would like to make before I close is that there was a reference by the public defender to a proposed order. And at the request of counsel and the DA and public defender, the interveners did get on a conference call last week to try to see if we couldn't come to an order, not that the interveners, at least from my client's perspective, could consent to, but perhaps one that they would no longer object to. And I raise this just because I want the court to understand that the media cannot consent or assent to a gag order, an order that restricts speech that lacks an evidentiary basis, no matter how narrowly tailored it is. And while we very much appreciate and respect the, I would say, concession by the parties to the case that the order is overbroad and needs to be narrowed, even if it had an evidentiary basis that justified its entry, the lack of any evidence in this case that there actually exists today a clear and present danger that the defendant's right to a fair trial precludes the media from conceding that any gag order is appropriate in the case. And therefore, we cannot consent or assent to such a order. Thank you.
Ms. Gaten?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just agree with Mr. Bauer. I will not repeat what he said. The only thing that I would note on the law enforcement restriction in the defense counsel's proposal is it just say active and inactive. I think they are talking about retired law enforcement and other individuals as well. And that's another reason we would submit that it's overbroad and a little bit unknowable as to who they mean, especially in this case where I think you've got, you know, Ben Hill law enforcement involved in another related case, and GBI involved in local law enforcement and active and retired. But other than that, we would agree with Mr.
Bauer. Thank you. All right, thank you. Anything else?
I would just like to add a couple things. I don't want to go back and forth, but I think first the standard is not whether there's a clear and present danger, it's whether there's a substantial likelihood of harm and prejudice. And I think it's certainly clear when you review these records. And I don't know what experience the counsel for the TV station has with criminal cases. But talking about voir dire and jury instructions and suppression of the jury is great if we're a week from trial. We're talking at least a year or possibly more from the trial of the case. There's no other way to limit this type of information, to limit the jury from being tainted by information could be released by law enforcement and others. It's just not possible. And I certainly didn't mean to imply the court that any of the opposing counsel had consented in any way to this order. It was just one that I thought was certainly fixing the problems that we have. But obviously, we were not able to reach agreement. And again, they discussed constitutional rights and First Amendment rights to media. And you know, while it's true to a certain point, the substantial likelihood of material prejudice standard is a constitutionally permissible balance between the First Amendment and the right to have a fair trial. And that's been spelled over and over again by the U.S. Supreme Court. We're also one more thing, address the AJC case. In that case, it discussed the non-lawyers, the trial participants. Apparently, the court in that case did not use the correct standard. And they basically said you've got to use the substantial likelihood of material prejudice standard. So there was no issue in that the media coverage. And I haven't even mentioned the fact that some of the information out there may or may not be admissible in a trial, which would further taint the jury panel, or what information may come out between now and the end of trial if law enforcement or other parties are allowed to speak on the stand. That's just another factor to consider. But again, we just ask that you delete the document that I provided. And I've asked you to admit the records that I've marked the exhibits.
Okay. Let me handle that first. Any legal objection as to why Exhibits 1 through 79 should not be admitted? I don't know if you've had a chance to really look at them yet, but I they're up here with me. I haven't looked at them yet.
Yeah. They're unauthenticated hearsay documents. I'm not entirely sure they're being offered for the truth of their contents, but there's multiple layers of hearsay documents. I'm not sure how much weight the court can put on them without a more robust authentication process.
Okay. Mr. Mulberry, are you...
I'm certainly not offering them the truth, but these are most material from my opposing counsel's clients. I'd be glad to call my paralegal, Ms. Robbins. She testifies to each exhibit that she did research, copied them, and they're true and authentic copies of what she saw on the screen, which is printed. However, I would ask the court not to do that.
Okay. I'm going to admit them. I don't think they're being offered for the truth of the matter. So I believe it was just for volume and the extent of coverage that is has been present. It is your motion. I'll give you the last chance to make a comment before we close.
Very briefly, I do think it's important in light of what Mr. Mobley just said that to just highlight what Mr. Hudson said. The Supreme Court law, Georgia law, is very clear that with all respect to a defendant's Sixth Amendment right, which are of course of the utmost importance, a defendant is not entitled to a jury that has no knowledge of anything in the case of the matter, and that alternatives have to be considered. And that is why the law is very clear that we are not talking about volume of coverage and fact of coverage, and the fact that some people may come into a jury pool and know some things about the case. And that is just insufficient to infringe on First Amendment constitutional rights. And that is, again, why we would say that the record is not established here for any category.
All right, thank you. Mr. Hudson, you're not present, so I forget to ask you if there's anything else that you'd like to add. All right. Thank you, Mr. Hudson. All right. I appreciate everybody being here today. Of course, I'm on review. I've read your motions. I guess I should have told you that before, so you'd have to reiterate anything that you didn't want to. But I've read all the motions, the briefs, and I have not had a chance to look at all the exhibits. I will take some time to do that, of course. And then I will do my own independent research. But hopefully within the next week, you'll have an order. Okay. I've got a trial week next week. We've got some time this weekend, so I'm hoping to get all that done. Okay, Ms. Gaethje?
Can I ask one question, Your Honor? I don't believe that the prosecution and defense will disagree with this, but of course they'll say if they do, but could Your Honor clarify, as Mr. Bauer asked, whether or not the records will be open in the meantime, the court files?
Oh, the court files?
Yes.
I know there's one thing. If I'm not mistaken, there was an order that sealed the record, okay? And somehow it got sealed, okay? So I will issue an order for the clerk to release that. I don't think there's a whole lot else there, to be honest with you. I think the warrants have been filed. There's not an indictment yet. So I'm not sure of a whole lot else other than what we're here about today. But I will ask her to release that, so at least you'll have that. I just don't want to say yes to opening all up because I don't know exactly what's there. Okay. All right. If anybody has anything else, I believe y'all all have my email address. We've been corresponding back and forth. So contact me if you need me. All right. All right. We're adjourned then. Thank you.
Now that we've heard the entire courtroom proceedings, let's get some input from defense attorney and legal analyst Philip Holloway.
Okay, wow. I thought we were here for a gag order modification hearing. But at the end, what we saw was the judge revealing that she'd done something much more remarkable. She signed an order basically shutting the public out of the complete process, directing that all hearings be held in camera. That means in her office until further order of this court. That means that any pretrial motions, perhaps even a trial or even a guilty plea, could be done behind closed doors. So in theory, Ryan could go in the judge's office and stipulate to a factual basis, enter a guilty plea, go off to prison, and we would never know what exactly happened to Tara Grinstead. This is absolutely astonishing because in America, we don't have closed criminal courts. In 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court slapped down a DeKalb County judge for doing essentially the same thing and said in no uncertain terms that courts must make every reasonable accommodation to let the public have access to criminal trials. We don't do secret trials or secret courts in America. It's just not how things are done. The other thing about this order sealing the record that's remarkable is that it was done without any kind of evidentiary hearing. We don't even know who asked for it. It just simply says it was filed February 28th at 3 p.m. Doesn't say which party asked for it. Was it both parties? Was it neither party? Was it the court on its own? Was it everybody acting together? If so, why? We need to know the answers to all of those things. I'm absolutely shocked by what was revealed almost by accident at the end of the hearing today. If it had not been for one of these media attorneys simply saying, you know, look, Judge, while you're thinking on this, will you just instruct your court staff to release the records in the case, the court records. And the judge says, oh, you probably didn't notice this, but I signed an order basically sealing it. In addition, I signed an order that said everything's going to be done privately, in secret. The wording used in the order, it says in camera, and in lawyer talk, that means in the judge's office. That's not how it's supposed to work. I have never seen anything like this before in my entire life. I have seen limited court closures for very specific reasons when you have very sensitive witnesses like small children, but not in a case like this. The worst case scenario would be that is if this order is not overturned or vacated, that the defendant could simply go into the judge's office, close the door, enter a plea of guilty, stipulate to a factual basis without giving any details whatsoever, and go off and spend the rest of his life in prison without the public ever knowing what happened to Tara Grinstead. The public does, in fact, have a right to access the courts. It's grounded in the First Amendment. The U.S. Supreme Court has underscored that fact, and this order simply cannot stand. I certainly hope the judge does the right thing and lifts it. If not, I would expect the appellate courts to do it for her. What I have confirmed as of today, Monday, March the 20th, is that the judge will include in her ruling on the gag order some ruling about whether or not the order to close the court will remain in place. She could decide to reverse herself. She could decide to double down on it and let it stand. And if that happens, I'm sure it will be appealed by the media. But she did indicate that she's going to address it without the need for further motion hearings involving evidence like what we saw last week. One thing I would tell everybody is that if they want to keep up with the most recent news and developments is to make sure that they check out Up and Vanished on Twitter, because that's where any breaking news will probably come first. I'm personally going to keep a very close eye on this, and just as soon as there's any new information about the court process, we're going to get it out right away.
Thanks for listening, guys. Don't forget to tune in on Monday, March 27th for episode 15. See you soon.
Why, hello there. Welcome to Radio Rental. If you're new around here and haven't heard, I'm your host, Terry Carnation. On Radio Rental, we play tapes of the scariest true stories you've ever heard. That's right, we've got real scary stories told by the people that actually experienced them. We've got stories of paranormal peril, near-death experiences, stitches in the space-time continuum, and more. Stories like these.
This person was looking for me. They start to take these long strides towards me. I was freaking out.
We started seeing it everywhere we went. It would be sitting there watching us.
I've never ran so fast in my life.
And it's all set right here at Radio Rental, the video rental shop of your worst nightmares. Radio Rental is available now. Listen 1 week early and ad-free on Tenderfoot Plus.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.